Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, a guest or two to help you lead a more positively minded life. And dedicated to you getting as many tools as you can get to understanding people, understanding yourself, and getting through day by day. Well, I was looking back and I was saying, you know, let's go back to basics here. And something came upon me that was kind of amazing. I remember something from a long time ago that I thought might be of interest to you. And for those of you who are familiar with this, I am sure you're going to feel excited just to hear it again. Work called Games and Life Scripts, How People Repeat Patterns from Childhood. How you set up some kind of a pattern in childhood, and you repeat that pattern over and over again. Well, now we're going to talk about things that happen in childhood that affect you and how those things manifest in common everyday interactions. My guest on radio, on telephone with me on radio, from California, Claude Steiner. Dr. Claude Steiner, who is one of the major characters in dealing with transactional analysis and this understanding. He's authored 3 books on dealing with this subject. One is about life scripts, which we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about your script, your thing, the thing that you do, the game that you run. And it's going to be real interesting. Claude, hi, you're with us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Nice to have you on.
Here I am in Berkeley.
Here you are in Berkeley. Hey, Claude, let's talk about this idea of games people play, all right? And the games that we get involved in and what kind of different games we all have.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, okay, so here's the thing is that people find themselves, you know, I think everybody has the experience of doing something over and over again that doesn't work, you know. Certain arguments, certain relationships, certain transactions with people that just repeat themselves, you know, and that's what it's called a game. It's a repetitive thing that is a negative thing in your life. Something you do repeatedly. Somehow you can't stop doing it. Whether it's getting into relationships with people that don't work for you, getting into arguments, being angry, being depressed, those types of things, and that's what a game is all about.
And we call it a game, meaning that it's some way that you in life developed of how to get through life. You're going to now play this game. You're going to be one thing or another. You're going to be playing the game. Let's give an example of some of these games, like in the relationships.
Well, I think that, you know, games tend to be in relationships. I mean, it's between two people, sometimes more intimate, sometimes less intimate. But let's take a game of uproar. Uproar is an interesting game. It doesn't necessarily happen in intimate situations, but there's certain people who always are getting into arguments, fights, you know, whether it's on the street or with the bus driver or whether it's somebody who's parking, you know, in their space or whatever, or whether it's their wife or whether it's their kids, but they're constantly getting into fights. And that's a game called Uproar.
Now, we say it's a game.
Yeah.
What makes it a game? Why isn't it just their feelings?
You know, the thing about it was called a game by Eric Byrne many, many years ago. I don't know exactly why that's such an apt word for that activity, but he thought of it as a kind of an entertainment thing. It's not so entertaining as it is very serious. He wrote a book called Games People Play, which was a huge bestseller, because it was so entertaining a book. You know, it kind of exposed people's foibles, the way they do things over and over again in sometimes very ridiculous ways. But it's a more serious, you know, I almost don't like to call it a game. It's a repetitive thing that we do that's really bad for us. You know?
It's a devious side of a transaction intended to get strokes.
Yeah,
now, let's talk about what a stroke is.
A stroke is like a really basic fundamental thing in life. I mean, we need to eat, we need to drink, we need to have shelter, and we need to have strokes. Strokes are basically the recognition that people give us, the love that they give us, that the affection that they give us is a stroke. However, sometimes when we can't get positive strokes, we'll take negative strokes. We'll take anything that is some kind of recognition. In the same way that if we're really, really hungry, we will eat rotten food, you know, or bad water. So even though what we want is recognition, affection, and so on. We'll get into these games to try to get the recognition and affection. But because we can't get the positive stuff, we'll settle with the negative stuff. So that's why people wind up fighting.
So a game of uproar is a game that means I'm going to at least have a connection with you through anger. I'm going to get angry. We're going to set up the situation, and you're going to see me blow it. You're going to see me lose my cool. You're going to see me as the person who is going to be very angry. And I'm most likely known to people as the person who might blow up.
Yeah, and also the person that we can get into a fight with if we want to get into a fight.
So if our game is to be either the victim of a fight, we will go to the uproar person because they play it so well.
Yeah.
And I like the way, because, you know, I really think when you talk about how serious these are, they are serious, but they did get a person through.
Yeah.
When a kid became a rebellious kid and threw a fit and they threw a tantrum, they sometimes got the attention they couldn't get otherwise.
Yeah. And today, when you're driving down the road and you're all lonely and upset and hurt and whatever, and somebody cuts you off at the road and you start screaming at him and so on, you know, you wind up feeling invigorated in some way, you know.
In some funny kind of way, you have an uproar and you're screaming, but in a way, you're having a relationship.
Yeah.
And because you're actually connecting with that person.
If you're playing a game, it always kind of makes you feel righteous about things. In other words, you feel, okay, so now this really proves that people are no good. You know, people are lazy, they're stupid, they're greedy. And that's really what a script is all about.
Well, we'll get to the script in a minute.
Yeah.
But uproar has a self-validating justification.
Right.
And so do all the games. Let's try a couple of the other games. One of the games I remember was Only Trying to Help.
Well, as far as validating game, I think that the even better one is, it's part of really Only Trying to Help, is called Why Don't You? Yes, But. That's a very interesting self-validating game. Because what happens is that a person who is depressed and unhappy will tell another person, you know, tell him, you know, something like, you know, I'm having problems with my wife, you know, my wife is so difficult. And then, so that sounds like you're asking for advice. And so then the other person will say, well, why don't you go to therapy? And then the response is, yes, but, you know, we can't afford therapy. Well, then the next point is, well, why don't you go to see a minister, a priest? Yes, but we're not religious. And well, why don't you go on a vacation together? That usually works. Well, we can't afford that. So anyway, it becomes a complaint of that sort, becomes a series of suggestions and then rejections of the ideas. And the whole idea to begin with is that you're depressed and life doesn't work. And so at the end, everybody is really depressed and convinced that life doesn't work, especially you can't give people advice. People don't take advice, so it's a very self-fulfilling type of self-validating activity, asking for advice and then not accepting it.
And it's kind of interesting because you, in a way, get power when you feel powerless. The game here is you ask for advice and you feel powerless, and when you refuse the advice by saying yes, but, you feel powerful. In effect, you invalidate the person who's giving the advice.
You're making the other person powerless.
Right. You're making them powerless.
And this is called a depressive game because in the end, everybody's depressed, you know.
Everybody loses.
Yeah.
Okay. Another kind of game would be called Do Me Something.
Yeah, Do Me Something.
Let's talk about that one.
It's a similar game in that, you know, it's like I'm unhappy. Let's say I'm in an intimate relationship. I'm sexually unhappy, okay? So the idea is do me something. Do something to make me enjoy sex, you know, and then no matter how hard the other person tries, it doesn't work. And it's the same idea, you know, it's like, do me something, and but it doesn't work.
What do you want for dinner? Do me something. I don't know.
I don't know.
Make something. Oh, I don't feel like having that. Oh,
Let's
I don't feel
out.
Like having that. Let's go out. I don't really want to do that. Do me something to make me happy. Interesting thing, Claude. One of our friends here recently wrote a book called Why Men Leave and talked about in her book, after an interview with a number of men as to why they left their relationships, the reason was what they felt powerless to make their mates feel better.
Yeah.
Was the majority of the rules. They felt the majority of the reason they left was because they felt powerless to improve the mood of their mate. What an interesting idea. There's a game, there's a place where the do me something ends up with the person leaving because they go off in life, and they call it midlife crisis, where they could suddenly find somebody else who will respond to what they do.
Yeah.
Do me something. Now, here's another of the games. I remember another of the popular games was look at what you made me do.
Yeah.
Now, how does that game work?
Well, I mean, here's somebody who feels that they can never do anything right. And, in fact, they're kind of clumsy and they don't learn the simple things like how to do dishes or how to balance a checkbook or how to drive or whatever. But it's really important for them to blame somebody else for their incapacity so that in every situation in which they might have to accomplish something, they find an excuse why they didn't. There's a very funny joke in the New Yorker where, I wish I could remember now. It escapes me. But anyway, the idea is that the person gets lost and looks over to his wife and goes, "Now are you happy?" You know? In other words, look what you made me do.
Look at what you made me do. Yeah. Look at him. Armand DeMille here with the Positive Mind. Dr. Claude Steiner, who, by the way, if you have to leave us, is easy to find on claudesteiner.com. claudesteiner.com. He has his three books on there. The three books, the most impressive one, well, I'm sure they're all impressive, but the one that touches me is this one called Life Scripts, which we're going to get to in a minute.
It's called Scripts People Live.
Scripts People Live.
Yeah.
It's the idea that we have started in early childhood to try to get our relationship with people based on some interaction, some way we had an interaction. And these interactions become the game that we set up in life, the game that we play. Now, games sometimes exist between two people, like two different people will get together and they'll both be playing two different games. It isn't that one is only playing the game. Usually, both people are playing the game.
Well, what it is you can't play a game by yourself, and there's always people out there who play your game with you. There's always complementary people. You know, there's the persecutor and the victim in an uproar game, always, and they find each other.
The persecutor and the victim. The uproar is the persecutor, and the victim will be the person who's always being yelled at and being victimized and being abused.
Right, and also then that will turn around. In other words, everybody who plays that game plays it from every position. The person, you get yelled at by one person, so then you yell at another person, and then that person yells at another person. And there's people who are into yelling at each other, and there's people who just will not participate in that. I mean, it's very interesting how you see sometimes people just do not engage that kind of a thing. They just kind of pull away from it, and they don't play those games.
Yeah, this was the appetizer at my family dinners when I was a kid. Yeah. Everybody came up and they played uproar. They just did it. It was an automatic family game.
Yeah.
So there's a compliment to every one of these. Here's another game. How about Now I've Got You? People play that game a lot.
Yeah, as is people who, you know, very often people are angry people. See, a lot of these games have to do with emotional attitudes. So here's an angry person, and they're angry at a relative, let's say, but they really can't, they don't feel that they can be angry at the tiny little things that they do that annoy them. So they basically add up things, you know. They add up, well, a little kind of the way they eat, and then the way they sit, and the way they blow their nose, and this and that. And they're getting angrier and angrier and more disgusted. And eventually this person does something that is big enough that you can say, well, now I got you. And then you blow up and give him hell. You know?
All the accumulated stuff.
Accumulated.
And you start talking about the past and everything else that's bothering you.
Yeah, and everything gets tied up into one big package that gets loaded on your head, and that's it.
Armand DeMille here with Claude Steiner. Claude, tell me some games that involve things like abandonment and betrayal. How about that as a couple? You know, a couple gets together, one's playing betrayal and the other's playing abandonment. How would those manifest?
Well, the thing is that early in life, people, you know, have these experiences, you know, of being abandoned and or of cutting themselves off emotionally and abandoning other people. So you got the abandoners and the abandoned, and they have their scripts, you know. One script would be to be the person who's always abandoned. And another person is the person who can't get emotionally involved, who will always abandon the person that they're with. Those two people get together, and they'll have a relationship. And then, of course, it goes in a certain way that is very predictable, especially to people who observe it, but even to themselves. And, you know, a lot of people who are abandoned over and over again expect to be abandoned.
And we'll create the abandonment.
And we'll create all the behavior with their games.
Well, let's stick with this for a minute, and let's lead this into how abandonment turns into an experience of abandonment, turns into a game and a life script.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's describe what a script is.
Well, right. It's kind of a decision that people make in early life, that life is going to be a certain way. For instance, let's say that you have been hurt many times, so you decide, okay, I'm not going to get involved with people. I'm not going to have any emotional connections with people. So from now on, every relationship that I'm going to have that's going to happen to me, at a certain point, it's going to get cut off emotionally. I'm not going to be able to pursue it. And the reason why that happens is because I will have played some games in which the person treats me badly and so on. And I repeatedly, because of my decision, have that experience and repeatedly, eventually decide, well, I'm going to have to leave this person or just leave the person.
So let's, we were using an example yesterday. Maybe we could go with that one today. Yeah. Let's say a person says, I'm going to have a relationship, and in order for me to have a deep relationship, I will always approach it as if I am somebody who is willing to do anything, right?
Yeah.
I am going to attract someone, let's say in this case a woman attracts a man,
yeah.
and I attract him by offering him everything I've got.
Yeah.
So he takes that and he says, oh, how wonderful. You are offering me everything. I will take everything you've got. And then she says, I offer you everything I've got but this one thing. Mm-hmm. And he says, okay, well, we'll deal with that one thing. I really don't like it. But all right, you need one thing. I'll give you one thing. And she says, as they get closer and closer, she says, okay, now it's come time because we are getting truly intimate. Mm-hmm. I've got to bring up another thing I don't want and another thing and another thing and another thing. Now he, on the other hand, is playing his game. His game was, I'm only going to go where it's safe. Mm-hmm. So he goes to this person who comes to him with open arms and says, I'll give you anything. And he says, all right, finally I'm safe. She doesn't need anything. Mm-hmm. But his script is that he's going to get betrayed. And he's going to turn around and say, see, I can't have a relationship. So this is all set in advance, set in stone. Before these two people even said hello, she is going to get abandoned and he's going to be betrayed.
Yeah.
And this is set when they say hello. This is when they're attracted to each other. Somehow they are going to both run their script so that they wind up with the same ending that they've always had. It's amazing.
Yeah, but you know, but in order to stay positive in this thing, it's important to realize that we do these things because we decided early in life on a very simple thing. It's not that complicated. It's either, in this case, it's either I can't trust people, people can't be trusted, or I will not open up myself emotionally, you know, something of that sort. I will not show my emotions to people completely. I will always hide behind my emotional kind of a stone wall. And it's that very simple decision that then creates all of these problems. So because it's actually a simple emotional decision, it's also something that can be changed when you're grown up. The way you were telling that story, I can see somebody hearing it and saying, well, I'm doomed. There's nothing I can do here. You know, I mean, it's completely set in stone, and I can never change it. But in fact, because these things are based on very simple emotional decisions early in life, all you have to do is find out what the decision was, and you have actually an avenue to change and to make things different. In other words,
there's where you are. You're kind of doomed. No, you're not necessarily doomed because, you know, sometimes these games wear out. Like, for example, if your game is based on good looks and you get to a point where you're beyond good looks, your game's not going to work anymore. So sometimes these things wear out. But it is introspection. It is the idea that you can look at yourself and understand the game that you're playing and watch the game that you're playing that busts the game.
The very fact
that you see it starts to change it.
Yeah, for instance, if you've noticed that you're constantly getting angry, you know, at people all over the place, then you can maybe, you can come to the conclusion that you've got a game of getting angry. Then you can work on this anger that comes up and deflect it. You have options. You have ways in which you can respond to angry situations by not responding to them.
And you can see the anger coming up and saying, wait a minute, that's my game.
Or
there it is. I'm in my game. I know I'm exactly where I am. I'm in this relationship, and I'm now screaming at the man I love or the woman I love.
Or let's say you are the kind of a person who is very afraid of showing emotions, and every time that, let's say, you're in a relationship and your partner says, do you love me? And you know you love him, but you can't say it because you're afraid of saying it, and you do this over and over again, and eventually partner after partner goes away, and then eventually you maybe decide, next time I feel I have an emotion, I'm going to talk about it, you know, because it's killing me. It's destroying my relationships. So these things can be these early decisions to be a certain way can be noticed, can be perceived, and they can be changed, and life can be changed in dramatic ways with these very simple awarenesses of how we decided early in life to be a certain way.
But we have to be conscious of it, and we have to, I think you said something important or suggested, you cannot judge yourself for your game once your game is exposed.
It's difficult.
Once it is exposed and once you see the script that you're running, you can't put yourself down for it because that puts you out of awareness. So let's say you go to a bar and you go and meet somebody, or you go to a juice bar and you go order a celery juice somewhere, not carrot because it's too sweet, we know. And you order a celery juice and you're with somebody and somebody next to you is ordering a celery juice and you say, hey. Now, already in your mind, if you're attracted to this person, you're probably attracted to the fact that they're going to abandon you.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably picking up somewhere inside you. Something looks at the way he drinks his celery juice and you know he's
aloof.
A good abandoner.
Yeah, they're aloof or they're... Maybe
they got a little something going on that says that's possible. He looks at you and has this idea. He knows that you're a possible betrayer. He could see it. He could see by the way you bite your celery juice. You know? I mean, it's somehow we pick up the signals. Because if you think about it, friends, we must be awfully smart to keep repeating the same patterns and getting the same results with people who look so different.
Mm-hmm.
They look so different initially. They look completely different.
Well, that's because you're perceiving something that's mostly not noticed. But if you become aware of these kinds of things, and you can watch people be that way. You know, you can watch the abandoners and the abandoned. You can watch the victims and the persecutors. You can watch the rescuers and the persecutors and the victims. I mean, these are all different roles that people play that you can just see. You know.
I saw a couple recently in therapy who came to me just for a consultation, an abandoner and a betrayer, just in that sense, where, you know, they were in the middle of this, the height of this. They loved each other so much, and the depth of the love was there.
Mm-hmm.
But the demons were screaming, do not get close.
Mm-hmm.
And they were screaming, and no matter what the resolution, they weren't going to get close, no matter what happened. And in the therapy session was very powerful. They really got together and dropped their games on the way, at the doorknob, on the way out the door. It was picked up again. And you could just see it. You could see the power of the thing that makes you not want to be vulnerable.
Well, one of the most basic things that I teach people is how to be affectionate with each other, how to give each other strokes, how to give them, how to ask for them, how to accept them, and how to give themselves strokes. That's as something that is extremely effective in softening these patterns of anger and unhappiness and betrayal and so on. And that is very easy to learn, you know. It's very straightforward, you know, just to know how to ask for a stroke of some kind of an affectionate thing, to know how to accept it when you're giving it, to know how to give it when it's asked.
Well, what are the mistakes that people make in knowing how to ask for a stroke when you want it? I mean, there are some people who are so needy, you know, they're always walking, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me?
Usually what happens there is that when they're told, they don't believe it.
And that's the game. Now we're in the game, right? The game is, do you love me? I'm not going to believe you anyway.
Well, that's the way the game goes. If you don't play the game, you say, well, you know what? I'm going to believe you, you know? Or sometimes the game goes like this, do you love me? And the answer is, well, you know, of course I love you. Well, that doesn't sound right. Do you love me? Well, would I be here if I didn't love you? Or do you love me? How many times do I have to tell you that I loved you? Never actually saying that they love the person. You know, that's the other way the game is
played. I like Woody Allen's response. I love you.
Yeah, right. There's no way to... Sometimes there's no way to get a certain person to tell you that they really like you. They will always equivocate. So that's sometimes the other side of the coin of the person who keeps saying, do you love me? It's because the other person will not really say that they love
you. They will not say it. Or if they say it, you won't believe it because at the moment you're feeling unlovable. If that script were exposed, if that game were exposed, the person would actually say, instead of saying, do you love me? They'd say, you know, at the moment, I feel unlovable.
Yeah.
There's something about me. And they would get underneath it before they ask the other person to jump in the game.
Right,
so it's like the game of, do you find that other woman attractive?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, a woman will say to her husband, do you find that other woman attractive?
Yeah.
Right? There's not a good
answer.
Good
one not to answer too well.
Right? This is, and listen to your response, that we can't answer that game. We can't answer that. There's nothing that you could say.
Well, what you can say is, you know, I don't know what you're asking, but I'm afraid that whatever I say isn't going to work. So are you asking me whether I find you attractive?
That's because you really did find her attractive. Yeah. That's why you're saying that, isn't it, Claude?
Right. I found, you know, if I tell you how I feel about this woman, you won't like it. How about that?
No, I'll like it. You just tell me the truth. I just want to hear the truth.
Well, okay, I'm going to tell you. And then
okay, yes, I want to know. Go ahead. Tell me. Did you find her attractive? Did you find her attractive or not? Tell me. Well, did you? Go ahead. Don't start laughing. Did
then I would say yes.
You did. I knew you did. I knew you did. I knew. Yes. I knew it. You were looking at her. How could you be with me and look at her?
Well, are you thinking that I don't find you attractive?
Yeah.
Well, that's not true. I love you, honey. Well,
I haven't seen you for many years, Claude, but I love you too. Hey, Claude, they talked about tragic scripts and banal scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that?
Well, I think it's a distinction because, you know, when we started thinking about scripts, we're only thinking of the very tragic ones, you know, alcoholism and rape and suicide and homicide and so on, because those were the most notorious, alcoholism being the most notorious, you know, because it seemed so obvious that people were just repeating themselves, doing it over and over again, you know, crime and so on.
Well, wait, talk about alcohol. Don't just run over alcoholism, because to you as a psychologist, it becomes real familiar. But how is that a game and how is that a script?
Well, it's obvious. Alcoholism is interesting. First of all, alcohol is just a terrible, terrible scourge. I mean, it's the worst thing. The most severe, you know, public health threat to our culture in almost every culture in the world. So, I mean, it's very serious, and there's lots of people who are being utterly and, you know, indescribably damaged by alcohol one way or the other. So it's very, very tragic when you see it, when you live it. And so I got very interested in it because it was so clearly a thing that people decided early in childhood. Very often they decided to follow the example of other alcoholics, you know. I mean, you know, you saw your Uncle Charlie get drunk every time that he was happy, every time that he was unhappy, every time anything, you know. So you decide early in life, and then you discover that you have certain weaknesses, that you can't control yourself in certain ways. Let's say that as a teenager you masturbate uncontrollably, so you decide that you are a weak person, and so that you're going to be eventually an alcoholic. So that's why it's a script, because people decide, I'm going to be that way. In addition, of course, there's certain genetic vulnerabilities to alcohol, you know, that some people are more easily addicted, but not everybody who is genetically easily addicted becomes an alcoholic. So anyway, we decide that we're going to become an alcoholic. Now, every time we get drunk, we're playing the game, you know.
Every time we're in it, we're playing the game.
Every time we go to a party and we say, okay, you know, should I drink, shouldn't I drink? So, well, okay, I'll have a drink. And then you're basically getting into the game, and before you know it, you're drunk and you do something stupid, and then you wake up next morning and you go, oh, my God, what did I do? You have a hangover, or you've spent a lot of money, or you've insulted somebody, and then you feel terribly guilty and you feel weak and useless. And then when you get over that, you go to another party or you get together and you drink again. It just goes over and over and over again.
In effect, if you're somebody who quells your emotions by drinking, by taking that first drink, it's every time you take the drink. Every time you decide that whatever I'm feeling, I want to alter chemically.
Yeah, that's one way that people are alcoholics. They self-medic. There's three actually different games of alcoholism that I identify and I wrote about in a book called Games Alcoholics Play, which incidentally is still in print. It's my earliest book, and it's still, you can buy it at bookstores. And so one of them is that you are basically trying to medicate away emotions that you can't handle. Another one is another game of alcoholic is called Drunken Proud, in which you're not trying to medicate away. You are actually very proud of being a drinker, and you enjoy the freedom and the kind of the easiness of it and the camaraderie and so on. And that's not necessarily a game of self-medication at all. So there's several ways in which people drink, but the problem is that in the end, it's always self-destructive.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with you in a little bit. Claude, stay with us, okay?
All right.
We'll be back in just a little bit. This is Armand DeMille. The Positive Mind, Dr. Claude Steiner. We'll be right back.
Your mind is a beautiful piece of engineering. It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and to be with yourself as well. Tune into The Positive Mind, Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
This is Armand DeMille back with you. Right now, we are talking with Dr. Claude Steiner. Okay, let's go back to this now. We were talking about life scripts, and among the life scripts, we said there are banal ones, and then there are others that are really toxic, the dramatic ones, such as drug addiction, suicide, mental illness. These are serious life scripts. There are scripts that you are meant to meet your death. Is that right?
Well, some one way or the other, I mean, tissue damage, real hurt, you know, real bad things happen to you. I mean, you could wind up in jail, you know, for the rest of your life. So it's not necessarily a death thing, but it could be death. It could be like, you know, really harmful self-damage where you wind up with a damaged liver or brain damage or something. It's not always death.
And a constant, but constantly moving yourself. If you're somebody who, for example, likes to walk on the edges of pain, on the edges of life, where you use pain as your reinforcer in life, the thing that makes you know you're alive, the thing that floods you with endorphins, and that's your attraction, then you're aiming in this direction towards, it's possible, serious life script.
Yeah. Well, it's not always quite, and that is very dramatic when actually people enjoy pain. That's not the usual thing, but it does happen. But, you know, it's generally just basically having very bad patterns of behavior and being accustomed to certain very violent options and using them and so on, and that's what leads you to these dramatic outcomes.
Outcomes, if the person winds up always being the victim of an abusive mate,
That's a
clear one.
Yeah.
You know, early childhood, you learned the only way to get love from your parent was to get a beating.
Yeah.
Right? The only time you got any attention was when they were whacking you around.
Yeah.
And somehow...
You know, they whack you around and then they feel guilty and apologize and love you for a while because of that kind of a thing. You know?
Right. Spank me and smooth me over, you know, and do both. I mean, it's not just about one or the other.
Yeah.
It's the way I get my love. It's when you feel bad after hurting me. That's the part I want in combination.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that could be real serious because you wind up as a serious victim if you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think the people who put these games out there, you know, and they say, and they dress accordingly and they have these little clubs where they're doing S&M games, I think they're ahead of the game a little bit because it's not so hidden. It's not so covert. And it even has certain limits.
Sometimes it's not a game. Sometimes it's just the way the pleasure is acquired, you know. So that's an important thing, distinction too. I mean, sometimes people do things that are peculiar, you know, to others. But they're not necessarily games. You know what? Before we go on, I wanted to just put this in context. All of this is part of transactional analysis. It's very important to realize that this is part of a larger point of view, a theory and a practice of psychology and of consulting and so on called transaction analysis, which was created by Eric Byrne, of who I am a disciple. It's important to realize that all of this got to do with transactions, the way people relate to each other. That's what we really focus on. And we've developed it as an alternative to psychoanalysis, which is looking at what goes on inside of people. What we do is we look at what goes on between people and find that. That's where we find our clues for understanding life and for changing it and making it better.
Yeah, there was a couple of course, quite a few people did that in life. I remember one school, the Sullivanians, who said, the only way you'll ever get to know yourself is in relationship to somebody else.
Right.
It is very easy on your own to go through life in this nice, safe way, saying, oh, I'm mentally healthy, I'm perfectly fine, as long as I never get close to anybody. But when you get in a relationship, when you form a committed relationship, there's where you find all your kinks in your armor are, you know, and that's where you find out who you really are.
And
that's
also
where you develop yourself.
Decide, if you think that you're going to be happy all by yourself, then you're going to find that very difficult too, you know what I mean? It's not possible really, because you don't get the strokes, and without strokes you can't really survive psychologically.
But there are people who do that, and part of their life script, let's go back to that, Claude, is to be alone. I am alone because there's nobody to trust. I am alone. I am depressed.
Yeah. Inevitably, now, that will have a depressive side.
And in that side, the alone, depressed side, that game goes on and on and on and on, and that one never stops.
Right.
Right? I knew a woman who had three cups in her kitchen. She had only three.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I never have more than two guests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would think about the fact that she had only two dishes,
yeah.
Three dishes, only three, meaning that she invites a couple over. But and she'll invite one person over, but never more than that. And in her entire life, most of her stuff is not used. And she had only three of everything.
Yeah, and some people only have one cup.
Now, people only have one cup because they know they don't need more. My God, they must do the dish. That's right. They have a dishwasher.
I think that's happening a lot nowadays. People are finding that the relationships are so difficult. And being alone is so much easier, especially with the help of the Internet and so on, that people are getting very isolated. And that's... you know, there's very clear evidence that depression is increasing because people are not relating to each other. That suicide and teenage suicide is increasing. There's all sorts of indications that this isolation that people are finding easier nowadays because of, actually, the Internet has a lot to do with it. I mean, television and all of the electronic media where you can actually feel like you're alive without ever having anything to do with another person.
That's right. You know, it always reminds me, whenever I see kids playing these games that they're playing on the computer, and they're actually playing these games alone with somebody else on the other side or just with a computer. And when I would play chess, especially in chess tournaments, there was an interaction with another chess player.
Sure. Yeah. And you get the illusion that you're actually relating to another person, and you get the kind of the experience, of the physical experience of relating, but it's lacking the actual life experience of relating to somebody else. And that is an extraordinarily important thing to learn, and we're forgetting it in huge numbers, I think. That's why one of the things I teach people is how to exchange strokes, because that is like the fundamental transaction of interaction with another person.
Well, if people are listening who are in a relationship, what are the key elements of exchanging strokes?
Well, like I said, you ask for strokes you want. You give the strokes that you're asked to give, as long as they're honest. You don't want to lie about it, you know. You accept the strokes that are given. You give yourself strokes.
But what's an example of stroke?
Well, I mean, you know, it's like...
somebody says, I want a kiss. Is that a stroke?
Of course. If somebody says, do you love me? That's just asking for a stroke. And then, of course, the question is, how do you answer? And you have to be honest, and then you need to say... you don't need to say, of course I love you, but, you know, you need to look at the person in the eye and say, I love you. I really do, you know. I love this about you. I love that about you. Well, tell me more about what you love about me, you know, then you ask.
Actually, if you're doing it right, the person wouldn't even say that. In other words, when someone says to you, do you love me? If you truly want to do your job as a lover, as a friend, stop and realize this is not a casual question.
Yeah.
Go over to that person, sit opposite them, look deeply in their eye, take a deep breath and exhale and say, do I love you? Let me tell you about my love for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you stop and say, I love you because you're so beautiful. I love you because every time I look at you, I feel a union with you that is so exquisite that it makes me just feel happy on the inside.
Right.
And you could do that, and you could do that and just send your love to the other person, right?
And then, of course, other person needs to be open to that, because very often when somebody says, "You're so beautiful," then something inside of you says, yeah, but you're old and you're getting older and you're getting fat and this and that. So you reject the stroke. You don't really hear it. You don't accept it. Very important thing to learn not to do.
Well, say that again.
Well, in other words, let's say that I asked my wife, "Do you love me?" And she says, "Yeah, I think you're so handsome," you know. But then inside of your head, there's something that'll tell you, well, you're handsome, but you're getting old. And the wrinkles in your face. And she only says that because she's not really. So you don't believe it. And you don't take the stroke in. So that's just as big a mistake that can happen as when you're asked for a stroke and you can't give it. So that's what I'm actually teaching in my book, Emotional Literacy. I'm teaching people the really intricate ins and outs of that type of an activity, because it isn't.
Well, we're gonna spend a program going over this whole idea of emotional literacy,
yeah,
Claude, because I do find it important, and I think we need the time to do that. Mm-hmm. Let's go back for a moment, if we would, onto scripts, because I think it's
okay.
What I told people we would be doing today.
All right.
In life scripts, sometimes there's a cultural script, and there are certain cultural groups that are depressed.
Yeah.
And the entire culture is depressed, yeah, and behaves in a depressive way.
Yeah.
And it's easier to buy into a cultural script because it's a certain way. Or like what I said about growing up in a family that was very loud and very noisy. It's very easy to buy into that tirade uproar script,
right,
and be a part of it because it was right there with the family, condoned the whole way. It was the only way we made contact with each other.
Yeah, and then you have what happens because you're constantly fighting is that there people get really angry, and then there are feuds, and then they have to take sides, and that becomes a cultural script where everybody's angry all the time. Or you do have the cultural scripts for people who are very afraid.
Well, okay, now these are some of the cultural scripts that we have that are easy to buy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of it is that somehow we got to step out of it. Now, one aspect of scripts is the existential payoff of games in the bad feelings,
yeah,
which are accumulated and eventually blow up and lead to an emotional disaster, you know?
Yeah.
Now, this somehow becomes what is called an emotional racket. What is an emotional racket?
Well, it's what we were talking about. I mean, if you are in a family in which, no matter what, you know, you can have like three families on the same block of a street. And they get up in the morning, and the baby has got a glass of milk, and the baby spills the milk. In household number one, everybody gets angry. Oh, God damn, why are you going to give him shouldn't have given him the milk and the baby and this and that and the other, okay? In the next household, people get depressed. Oh, the milk is spilled again, and now what are we going to do? And so on and so forth, all right? In the third household, everybody feels guilty. So these are the rackets. These are the ways in which we live our lives in stuck in certain emotional situations that we just continually do. It's part of the game idea. You know.
If we were to look at our games and look at our scripts, there are some people who would say that there are different roles that we get, and there are three roles that you could break your scripts down to, I believe.
Games.
Yes, and the three basic game rules are persecutor, rescuer, and victim. Now,
yeah,
most people will fall into one of these three categories.
Well, what
they're
it
either
is
the
that
persecutor, they're either the rescuer, or the victim. Now, let's talk about what a persecutor is like.
Well, a persecutor is somebody who's always persecuting, you know, angry, yelling, accusing, judging, you know, just being, blaming, and so on. But, you know, I want to point this out. There's lots of games and lots of roles, but the three main roles are, like you said, rescuer, persecutor, and victim. Now, the thing about the game roles is that it's not that you play one of them. You play all three. If you are a persecutor, let me give you the very good example of the rescuer, persecutor, victim game, in which what happens is that, let's say, and alcoholics and therapists play that a lot. Let's say you are a therapist, and somebody comes to you as an alcoholic, and they're basically a victim. They are sick. They are unhappy. Their wife has left them, etc. All right, so now they're the victim, and you are going to be the rescuer. You're going to make lots of suggestions. You know, you're going to work real hard to make this person try to get better and so on. And you're going to work hard, and you're going to do all sorts of things, and while the victim really isn't doing anything much. Eventually, after maybe many sessions of therapy in which you tried the best you could, but the guy continues to drink and eventually gets drunk, and calls you in the middle of the night and calls you a bunch of names, then you suddenly are going to switch from rescuer to persecutor. Well, I tried so hard, this person is useless, he's psychotic, blah, blah, blah. So you've gone from persecutor, from rescuer to persecutor, and then the alcoholic will victimize you, you know, make you feel like a victim, call you in the middle of the night. Your colleagues are going to think that you're a bad therapist and so on. So everybody plays all roles. If you play any role in the game, you'll wind up playing all three of them.
Now, one of the things that I think people could be aware of in life, that between two people, they're alternating persecutor, rescuer, and victim.
Very important.
If you're aware of it, if you could just be aware of it, think about your relationship. Anybody who's listening right now, think about your relationship as of last night.
Yeah.
Think about a relationship you had last night. Last night you had an interaction with someone you care about. It could be anyone, including your dog. Mm-hmm. You had a relationship with somebody, or your cat, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And you had a relationship with someone, and you had some kind of an exchange. What was your role with that person? Were you persecutor, were you rescuer, or were you victim? Any kind of a negative exchange usually will have to it the persecutor, rescuer, or victim. Being aware that you befall into one of those categories. Oh, now I'm the rescuer, huh? Let me step back from this role. Let me not rescue. Now I'm the persecutor. Let me step back from this. Let me not persecute. Oh, now I'm the victim. I see it. I could see myself sinking into this victim. Let me step back from this.
Right.
Maybe I could do it differently. Is that
and
the
you
idea?
You should also know that if you are going to be the persecutor, if you are the persecutor today, you'll be the victim tomorrow. If you're the rescuer today, you'll be the persecutor or the victim tomorrow. I mean, anything of that sort that you do is going to come up. It's going to go around and round and round. That's what it's like a merry-go-round where we go from persecutor to victim to rescue. And you're right, absolutely right. Just look at anything you've done in a relationship where you're having difficulties, and you'll find that you're going, you have a favorite role, but you wind up playing all three.
That's called the drama triangle, right?
Yeah, the drama triangle.
That's
very
called
important.
The drama triangle.
Very important part of the ideas.
My guest is Claude Steiner. It is claudesteiner.com, and if you want to ask him any questions, I guess I know when they go to your internet site, they can also get they can get email exchange with you, right?
Oh yeah, it's a very nice site. I think people will enjoy it.
Did not start his work in 1995.
No, I changed that. I already changed that.
You're ready? That was fast.
Yeah, well, I do my own website.
You do?
Yeah.
I thought Claude, I remember Claude back from the 60s, and I looked at his website and he said he started his work in 1995.
Oh.
They turned that 6 upside down. I didn't know computers could do that.
Yeah.
Well, Claude, it's really been nice. It's been really real special being able to talk to you.
Me too.
We're going to continue on with this, and I know the next program we do is going to be on this issue of emotional literacy, which I think is an important concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to, we'll have to take a whole day and do it. One last thing, if you don't. Do you remember the idea of hot potatoes? The idea?
Sure.
Talk about it. I think it's valuable.
Well, I mean, we try to we have problems. I mean, that's what a game is all about. I mean, we start out with a strong need for affection. And we have a problem getting affection. And then when we try to get involved with a person and we don't get the affection we want, then we're going to get angry at that person and we're going to kind of lay that whole thing on them, you know, and try to blame them for the whole thing. So we pass these things around, you know. This is the thing about transactional analysis. It's a very interactive kind of a thing. It pays attention to the fact that human beings are constantly interacting and passing things back and forth, you know. And one of the things we pass on is each other's problems. We pass them on as hot potatoes.
And why do you call it hot potatoes?
Well, you know, I don't know, it's a game called hot potato where you...
Oh, you just pass something on from one person to the next.
Yeah. The game is like you're not supposed to be caught with an object in your hand. It's called a hot potato. So you just pass it on to the next person. And then when the music stops, it's like musical chairs. You know, you got the hot potato in your hand, you lose. You know?
Gotcha.
It's just a one. You know what happens? The transaction analysis, when it was first conceived of, it was full of very cute and interesting and clever ideas. That's what made it so popular. Some of those ideas are, nowadays people in psychology want to be more serious. They don't want to talk about cute things like games and and now gotcha or whatever and hot potatoes. So these are kind of relics from the 60s where we used to talk in these ways. You know, now we are much more serious.
Well, now we try to be more serious, but yeah. I tell you the truth, what I find is that we could bring back some of these old ideas because it does bring with it some of the lightness and love for people that was included in it.
Yeah.
Special thanks, Claude Steiner. Thank
you.
Be with you again.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org or you can go to thepositivemind.com where you'll hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.